Hello, this is Swan Drishti, and you are listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Today I'm joined again by Sarah.
Hello.
I keep roping you in.
When are you going to officially make me your co-host?
I don't know. I think maybe we have to, like, drink mead or something, and
yes.
You might have to sell your soul to me, but she's...
Well, it's kind of on borrowed time anyhow.
So we have Sarah Decker here with us again because she's wonderful and very conversational and also knows Gary, who is our guest today. Gary Ledhart?
Ledhart.
Thank you.
Can I tell him the nickname that I was told for you from Spo? Remember Spo?
Yeah.
Is Gare Bear.
Really?
So every time I refer to you, it's, oh, Gare Bear.
Yes.
And every time I tell her, like,
I don't think
Spo
ever told that to her.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, I'm doing my independent study with Gary Ledhart. She's like, oh, Gare Bear. I'm like, oh. So yeah, every time I see you.
So Gary Ledhart professionally, Gare Bear.
Socially.
Also. And professor at Dartmouth, you're interested most in contemporary poetry, but teach creative writing.
I teach a poetry workshop in the MALS program.
Yes.
I teach an undergraduate course in the English department called Contemporary American Poetry.
Uh-huh.
And then I teach an introductory first-year composition course.
First-year composition.
In the writing program.
Writing 2-3, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So not creative writing. I just made that up.
Well, I used to, that's funny. The first course I taught at Dartmouth was creative writing.
Okay,
because it was an AD course, Introduction to Creative Writing.
Maybe the.
But over the years, as I got the contemporary poetry course and the MALS poetry workshop,
mm-hmm,
I didn't have room for the creative writing.
I don't know where I picked that up. Maybe an old internet article
or
something. Before we launch into our show, I do need to read on behalf of Radio Free Brooklyn an announcement that there is an organization called Start Treatment and Recovery Centers that is hiring. If you want to work with the great people in a recovery situation, they are having an open house Friday the 16th, 3:30 to 7 p.m. and Saturday the 17th, 10 to 2. This is at 937 Fulton Street in Brooklyn. So check that out if you're unemployed, I guess. Right into our show, I love the trajectory of your, career path, creative path, where you started out thinking you were going to play baseball, ended up getting injured on the playground, and that's when you discovered books. You didn't really come from a family that was very literary.
Literally not literary.
Yeah, sometimes words are hard. As any writer can tell you. Do you want to speak a little bit more to this like avenue that kind of brought you to where you are now?
Well, I don't think it's so unusual. The more I speak to other writers, especially of my generation, there had to be something that some time that they spent learning to read and write,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't built into their life.
Mm.
It certainly wasn't built into my life.
Mm-hmm.
Like it wasn't foundational,
right?
Yeah.
But then once I was incapacitated for physical activity for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my grandmother, bless her soul, gave me a subscription to the Sporting News, which
mm-hmm.
was an old newspaper from published in St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
which had all this kind of, and I would just read
cover to cover.
Everything.
Sporting
news.
Really
even sports I didn't know anything about.
Mm-hmm.
It stretched the vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started reading everything. And then, later on I went to college and started learning how to pronounce some of those words that I knew, but I didn't know how to, I'd never heard anybody say it.
Yeah.
My wife actually kind of did the same thing. Like, she was into reading because she's kind of a solo type person. And so words like chaos, where chaos, you know,
yeah.
You know, and then when you hear it, right, yeah. So
English
yeah.
is silly.
But
yeah.
I mean, why can't it be chaos, or, you know,
yeah.
why does it have to be
yeah.
chaos? And
yeah,
but yeah, because
yeah.
you got the
I
meaning
think,
of the word, but not
I think
the,
that's
not
a common. I think there's even a name for it, but it's a common symptom mm-hmm. of readers to pronounce things the way that they're read rather than the
right.
correct pronunciation.
Yeah. Yeah, because yeah, right. you're not learning the
you're
language.
Not saying it.
Right.
You're not
talking
looking
to somebody.
Up new words.
Yeah, no, the
dictionary's
reading it to you. You're reading it
yeah.
to yourself, and so yeah.
I mean, yeah.
And one of the things my mother was very strong about was never to correct anybody's pronunciation.
Ooh, she was the opposite.
Oh,
of
my mom
so,
was
off. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
No. So you know, and
she was just not her.
And
head.
My grandparents, they.
Right.
They had unusual pronunciations for everything,
right.
And you know, and you just say, "Oh, okay," and you know, and you
right.
you'd incorporate that into your
right.
conversation.
Yeah.
The next time you said the word, if you said it, you'd mispronounce it,
right.
you know, so that everybody would be comfortable.
Right.
That's very considerate of your family,
right? Not to be like it's this way, not that
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. I was trying to think of a story my friend told of someone misusing a word, but I don't think it's relevant. So you caught the reading bug, reading sports.
Yeah,
sports
I
news.
Mean, obviously,
and this,
you want to read something else pretty soon.
Yeah, and then they carried over to comics for you.
Yeah,
are you
yeah.
still a consumer of comics?
No, though I still read Mouse in my first year composition
mm-hmm.
class, but...
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a great consumer of comics anymore.
So that's comics is one like genre that I always wish I knew more about, but it seems so overwhelming now. I've read a handful. That's all I can say.
I gotta say that the Dartmouth Library has a nice collection of comic books. They have a fund for
mm-hmm.
that.
I think it's more an issue of decision paralysis.
Right, because there's so many. Like
there's so many.
Where do I start?
Yes.
Well, you know, the other thing is, there were. I used to read this comic book Mouse in my class,
mm-hmm.
and then I quit. And then I had dinner with two seniors who were studio art majors,
mm-hmm.
and who had been in my class. And
mm-hmm.
they said, "Oh, we just love that because it was visual."
Right.
And you realize that for different people with different learning styles,
yeah.
you should have something in there that's
mm-hmm.
visual and that they
right.
can relate to.
Right.
You know?
Nice. I mean, I definitely have enjoyed, and children's books, I think, are underappreciated by the adult community. They're
mm-hmm.
so great, and
yeah.
it just takes a couple minutes to read one, so, especially with illustration being so incredible today. Anyways. So, you had this period of being cooped up, caught the reading bug, never really went away, ended up getting your undergrad in English.
Yes, and I just fell into that. I started college as a math major,
mm-hmm.
and then the math course was boring. And, and by the time I got to graduate, I had more courses in English
oh, really?
Than anything else. So it was just easier to graduate in English.
That worked out.
So you weren't going towards like English.
I had no
major.
Idea. No, I just
You're
thought,
just like,
oh, that's interesting.
I
it's
wanna
much,
take this
as
course,
much,
I'd like
much
to take
more
that
interesting
course.
To take.
That's
17th century literature than it
right.
is to take this
yeah,
math course.
Yeah, I think
course,
my,
you know?
My undergrad was like maybe 6 years longer than
yeah.
I would have been like a creative writing, art history, you know,
yeah.
studio art major.
Yeah, yeah you just
early childhood
take
education.
The courses,
all the
right?
things.
Because all the things I wanted to take.
Yeah.
yeah. I mean, I think over the course of a life, you end up having careers and all these things, but trying to
yeah,
find
sure.
something that
yeah.
is like a fusion.
Right.
Of all your interests. That's the challenge of life, I suppose.
Well, yeah, again, fortunately, when I went to school, there were fewer choices.
Right.
The curriculum was.
Touché.
Yeah.
Talk to me about poetry. At what point did poetry enter your life? And who... I read a little bit, but talk a little bit
yeah.
about the poets who influenced you.
Well, you know, I mean... First, I had the standard kind of poetry background. I'd gone to college and majored in English, and so, I read T.S. Eliot and Robert Frost, and you know, but in a small bookstore in Albany, New York, there in the back, and it must have been the bookstore owner. He had all these little poetry books, these little chap books by people like Ed Dorn and Diane DePrima and Leroy Jones. And I started reading them and figuring out, I didn't know who these people were, you know, but, and then I went to graduate school in Madison, Wisconsin. And I found in the library books by these New York poets, Ron Padgett and Ted Berrigan, and who weren't that much older than I was, and were actually writing in a language that wasn't
archaic,
wasn't like literary, right? Yeah. They were actually writing in a language that I knew,
kind of conversational language.
And I thought, oh, you can write poems in contemporary American English.
Doesn't have to be either contemporary.
Yeah, yeah. So that was big, and then I moved from Madison to New York, and kind of found these people soon.
Mm-hmm.
New York isn't as big as Manhattan isn't as big as it's reputed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read,
circles overlap.
That's right.
Very common.
And you start meeting all these people, and and so. From there, I mean, you know, I've discovered a new poet last week, but you're always looking for new poets, you know?
Yes. I think that is a little overwhelming sometimes, to think that no matter how much you invest time, there's always more to find and cover. But kind of nice, too.
You're not going to exhaust the
field
of reading.
That's out there.
You're not gonna read every poet there is.
Yeah.
And
you don't want to.
Right. You want to read the ones that kind of resonate with you.
Yes.
I mean, why would you spend your life reading poetry that you don't like?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. There's a lot of poetry.
Well, so what do you think about? We talked a little bit about commentary on poems, and it sounds like you don't think that a poet should add anything, that the poem should be able to stand alone. But what do you think about poems that aren't quite as accessible, that maybe you have to read a number of times before you start to like grasp something from that?
Well, the question is why it's not accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Because some poems are not accessible because you don't share the frame of reference, and so the poet is making allusions that you don't get. For example, I have a friend, Joe Lewis, who is a jazz buff, and lots of times he's referring to obscure or not so obscure jazz tunes that I don't really
understand. If you don't
understand.
Know jazz.
That's different than if you're reading it and it's inaccessible because of the vocabulary, or because of the poets being elusive, like say John Ashbery. I don't mean to say that John Ashbery is inaccessible, but if you're looking for a certain message, you may finish reading a book by John Ashbery and say, "What was he trying to say?"
Right? What's the takeaway?
Yeah.
There's no tie in this, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think about the oral tradition of poetry? We talked a little bit about, as a reader, you start to pronounce words the way they're written. As poets, I think, and especially now, there can be a tendency to just see words on a page and not read it out loud. And yet most exposure to poetry, there's this admonition to say it out loud, because it's part of the cadence, it's part of the experience. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on this as a teacher?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on it. I mean, because there are worlds of poetry, you know, and students tend to have suspicions about, well, is that really a poem or is that a song?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't have that. You know, when Dylan won the Nobel Prize, I didn't have I wasn't outraged as some
a lot of people were.
As some poets are.
I think, yeah. I was,
you know? Because it seemed to me that he was putting words together in a way that, you know, that aren't that different from the way that many people in the oral tradition mm-hmm. put words together. And so I think, I mean, if it's, poetry is about words and yes. it's about language. And that's why different people have respond to different poets mm-hmm. and different poetries. And you know, and if somebody, if pop music does it for somebody and that exhausts all of their shades of emotion, well then that's fine.
And I think of Leonard Cohen, who considered himself a poet, but he, I'm not quite sure where he said this, but he said, you know, if I just read my poetry, nobody would listen. I had to make it into music so that I could get the message out. And I think that there's some truth behind that. And I mean, we laud musicians who are also wordsmiths
mm-hmm.
Outside of the pop music realm.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I just meant by pop, I just meant songs without any complexity. That's
right.
What I really meant.
Or that people don't see as being complex because they're in the mainstream, they're catchy in some way. And
And this also speaks to a book that you wrote about, I can't remember how you termed it, but just like poets coming from different backgrounds and then being criticized or...
Oh, is this the stamp of class? Is that what you...
Yes.
Yeah, it was poetry and social class.
Yes.
And it was it kind of looking at the way that people from different backgrounds became poets and what happened to them because of that. And certain things that they could do and certain things that they couldn't handle or to turn it around.
Mm-hmm.
I had that chapter about William Krause Williams trying to publish in the Communist magazine, the masses.
And they said you're a doctor.
And they said they don't want you because you're a doctor.
Right.
Yeah.
And you were explaining to me, you know, I'm not sure what year, but, you know, years ago, the upper class, the elitists, so to speak, would seek out poets from the lower class to give voice to that experience, and they didn't want people from upper class,
right? But they wanted those people to be,
but a certain type
they,
of person,
right?
A certain,
you could destroy your career by trying to jump from an uneducated poet or the thresher poet to being an educated poet.
Because
mm-hmm.
that was kind of transgressive.
Yeah, you wanted to kind of play up your
niche,
low roots,
your
humble beginnings, even if you had some success and developed more education.
Yeah, we have a similar dynamic today. If somebody mm-hmm. is considered, somebody is singing working class country songs or rap. And then all of a sudden they want
Garth
to put
Brooks.
Right,
oh
and then
my
they
God.
Want
that's
to
what came to my mind. Too,
put out a book that was more literary. There would be a lot of controversy about that.
No, when you're talking about that, that's what came to my mind is Garth Brooks. Chris Gaines was his new alter ego, like his rock ego.
Oh,
interesting.
You know, and there's lots of controversy. Like, how can you go from country into rock, and then why did he change his name? And
You can never please all the people.
Right.
It does make me think, though, a little bit about how I think it's human nature to try and categorize something and put it in a box.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have a tendency, especially, to do that with artists. I remember reading about Marina Abramović and how she was constantly trying to push herself outside of the box that people were putting her in.
Mm.
As a performance artist, you know, trying to really push, like, what is performance art and how do I do something that is actually, you know, challenging people as opposed to just, like, I don't know, doing something that is similar to what I've done before.
Right, something that's comfortable, that's,
But, and I think there's the familiarity thing, too, that, you know, you get comfortable with Garth Brooks as a country singer, for example, and then something is presented that's different.
And he has a goatee.
Yeah.
And your initial reaction, to anything that's new or, you know, challenging your perception is you want to resist that.
Right.
So I think poetry offers the opportunity to hold space for discomfort.
Well, yeah, and you know, I was thinking the poet Angie Malenko, who said that she's always experimenting and trying to do something that she hasn't performed before,
mm-hmm.
and you know, that a certain, especially in what we call pop music, in the sense that it's a capitalist.
Mm-hmm.
Phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want you to change their brand.
Yeah, exactly.
Know?
Yeah,
right.
They have their formulas worked
yeah.
out.
Yeah.
They know what sells.
Right. Well, and when you're a writer yourself, like, I don't know if you deal with this or if you do as well, if, like, you wonder what kind of bibliography are you creating? You know,
yeah.
like your biography, right?
Mm-hmm.
What you start to publish, that's like the beginning of your biography.
Yeah.
Right, so if your first
people see
right, and so if your first one is like a book of love poetry, right?
Yeah.
Then you're the love
poet.
You're the
right.
Love poet. That's
then,
right.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
I forgot what I was gonna say. That was a great comment, Sarah.
Why? Thank you. So
much.
I was reading the cue card pretty well, huh?
Yeah. Okay, let me find my next cue card. Well, I was thinking about poetry. I want to talk a little bit about you and your output. Right now, your writing predominantly falls into two categories, poetry and prose. And you mentioned a little bit about your process for each, and it seems like they're pretty different. So I'd love you to talk to that.
Yeah,
to that.
Because poetry is something that I do when something inspires me,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
and it could be a phrase, or it could be an idea, or it can be a perception,
feeling.
What,
yeah.
but
or yeah, thought or
yeah.
yeah,
and prose is usually in response to some idea I have, either an assignment that I get, or an assignment that I give myself,
right?
Right? So that and I say, oh, I'm going to write about this. And then I can sit down and I can say, well, what do I have to say about this? And I kind of do it like an academic
mm-hmm.
essay.
Yeah.
I mean, or an essay.
And
I just do it like
down
an essay.
And
sit
and
down.
Get it out.
Right?
Yeah.
Certain hours.
Large blocks.
Just do
of
it.
Time,
large blocks
of
time.
Large blocks of words.
Whereas, you know, poetry, I tend to write on little scraps of paper
mm-hmm.
and with pen and or in a notebook and then
in the middle of the
and,
night and it's
yeah,
all
in the middle of the night
definitely.
In the middle of the night and then
yeah.
kind of put it together and then maybe try to seal it a little bit or make it connect but it's a very different process.
And you said you tend to publish about every 8 years is just kind of how the rhythm came out for you.
The books of poems have been about every 8 years, yeah.
And you said that your output is about 10 to 15 poems per year. Is that...
Yeah, I think that's what I keep,
uh-huh.
you know? I write a lot more.
But the ones that are kept are
But I write a lot more, but the ones that I choose to publish...
Is
come
it a
about the
feeling
10 or 15?
That you get when you're like, okay, this is done, like this is a poem now versus like this is a work in progress?
Well, yeah. I mean, sometimes you feel like there's nothing more to say about
mm-hmm.
this. This poem is finished.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, and then sometimes you feel like this poem is finished because it just died.
Mm.
Right, and
yeah.
that, those
and
are the ones that
you,
those
go
are the
any
ones
further with it.
That you just
like,
leave
and dead end.
Those are the ones you just leave. But then sometimes you think, like, you know, this is it. This is, you know, I don't want to overwork this,
mm-hmm.
right? Like with a painting,
mm-hmm.
you get to a certain part and you say, if I keep
right.
working on this, it's gonna die.
Alter the
yeah.
whole
it's a delicate
composition.
Yeah.
yeah, yeah.
And then my other question on this line of thought is I'm really interested about Maybe your experience of looking back on earlier poems that you've written after they've had time to breathe and you've changed, do they still feel complete, or is there this poet's desire to keep changing things?
Well, I wouldn't change them, you know.
No.
I'm no, because they were written by a different person.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, you know, I teach this undergraduate class where people have to read a poem, present some poems during the term, and almost every year somebody chooses to read a poem of mine. And it's kind of nice to hear it in somebody else's voice. And they're closer to the age at which I wrote it than
okay.
I am. So it's nice to hear it in a vigorous young voice. And but, you know, so I wouldn't touch it because it's so different from if I went back and tried to rewrite it with the perspective that I have now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, first of all, I don't think the emotion would be coincident.
Yeah, you can't really recreate that.
No.
What if it's angst or, you know, terror, fear, happiness, like,
or just
yeah.
your outlook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your perspective, yeah,
yeah.
You can't really recreate that. That's a good point.
Nice. I like it. And I like the comparisons to painting because I do see a lot of similarities between you know, visual art involving paint and poetry where you're, you know, changing words and tweaking things just a little bit.
And also the topography, too. Like,
and the,
that matters.
Yeah, the interface. Oh, you mentioned something really interesting about, you know, this movement from poems that are oriented on the left margin because of typesetting versus now where most everything becomes centered on a page, which may or may not change the way that the poem is read and experienced.
Well, I think the fact that poetry has become more prosy, so that the left margin and then iambic pentameter, it's not as important anymore, but now people are reading, going back and reading those old poems because they encounter them on a page centered,
yeah.
so that they may be reading right on a computer screen, right, not a page. You're right, a computer screen, and so they're going back and they're
read
reading.
Books.
They're reading
poetry books, even rarer,
yeah.
but it does happen,
yeah.
right?
And you know, and they're going back and they're reading Keats or Shelley, and it's centered.
It's centered,
you know.
Yeah.
And you think it's makes it more accessible to them to read it that way, or
I just think it's a different attention to
yeah.
a different idea of what the poem
doesn't seem so stodgy.
It is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's something about like a visual on a screen. I think people like things centered. Maybe like the eye holds it better. I'm curious about the science, because you would think like coming from, you know, printmaking, that some of the same ideas would carry over.
Well, you know, Charles Olson, his ideas of the way a poem looked on a page depended a lot on the typewriter. So, you know, and
it still depends on the word processor too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And poets 50 years before that didn't have a typewriter.
Right.
And poets now.
I have so many poets on my show even who read from their phone, and that's something that I cannot understand because it's so disjointed for me to try and read from a screen.
Right.
It has to be printed
scrolling,
out or I have to write it. But I mean, for a lot of new, you know, people from my generation, a phone is a tool that's creative.
Right.
And it's where they capture, you know, those lines and those words.
I'm kind of in the limbo of that. Like, I'll write, I don't like to write on my screen. Like, I rarely will write anything like a poem or any kind of prose on my phone or, you know, laptop. I like to write it out by hand, but then I also want to transfer that onto this, to my phone or
to
my laptop so that I have it available. And it's like, because then, you know, if I want to rewrite the poem, I'm rewriting it by hand. I'm flipping through the pages to, okay, well, what did I say? You know, but whereas, like, you could have it open.
Search it.
Right.
That's powerful. When I started this radio show, I was in the process of transcribing my journals, and it was really fascinating to be able to search, and also there's all these interesting statistics. So, like, I can go look at my journals from 2007 and see what words I used the most, and I'm just like, what the heck?
Right.
This is so strange.
Yeah.
This is all through Scrivener, which as a writer, if you're curious about a program software for writing, Scrivener allows you a lot of really writing friendly, interesting tools.
Yeah.
It's what I use, and I don't even use it to its full potential, I know. I remembered my cue card. Did you? From 10 minutes ago. You mentioned capitalism in pop music. I'm curious about the perceived lack of capitalism with poetry, because there's this romanticized, like, a poet is, you know, this pauper, and especially in publishing, like, poets are not really making a profit from their poetry, and publishers are not really interested in taking them. You know, if you do publish a book of poetry or short stories, I think can be lumped into this. It's usually because you published a bigger book.
Right.
And then the publisher is like, okay, you can have your cute little small book. What do you feel about that? You're obviously a professor, and that's your livelihood, and the poetry comes in on the side. Yeah,
that's why it's my livelihood, right?
Not a poet.
one teaches because you need a livelihood, right? But There's this book called The Gift by Lewis Hyde.
Oh, right? My God, so good. I also just picked up his book about trickster archetype. Anyways, so plug those two. They're both amazing. Hard to read sometimes, but very amazing.
Worth it, right?
Yes.
Worth it. And it seems to me that that's what poetry is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people say you can't give it away, well, you actually have to give it away.
You have to.
And that's what you do, is you give it away.
And somehow something comes back to you.
And people, I believe that some people really need it.
Yeah.
And they can use it.
Right.
And it makes a big difference in their life.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's a gift that they've gotten from this person, whoever it is.
Yeah. And I think, in the gift, it talks about, you know, gift economy and this idea of reciprocity versus the, you know, capitalism is like, here's what I'm offering. How much money can I get for it? Whereas reciprocity, is more this concept of, like, here's what I have to bring to the table, and I'm just going to trust that other things will come back to me.
Right, not expecting a certain amount to come back, but just, like, I'll give, and whatever comes back is great.
Yeah, it's a less tangible, less trackable system, but I think more community-based and more relationship-based.
More to do with
if I was inspired by somebody to write a poem and I shared that with them, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not expecting, like, oh, here's $10, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, you inspired this in me, I'm gonna, you know, I wanted to share that with you. And
I think this what we're talking about, this the gift, you know, putting things out there. We're so saturated, and especially with the digital and global, like, connections that we have, that I really do value the work of a poet in creating community and bringing our attention back to smaller realms or more simple approaches. And I think that's the appeal of poetry now for a lot of people, I think, is just to kind of help them slow down, I hope.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think hearing someone firsthand read their poems it seems to have a different effect than seeing somebody on the screen in the movie house reading a poem.
Mm-hmm.
So not that you see that very often, but But somebody stands up before you and reads a poem, it really makes a difference. And
right.
and
there's a presence.
Yeah, there's a presence. Right.
Yeah, in the performance piece, I think that there's, it's like sports. I'll go to any sport live because I'm there and I can feel the energy and I'm with the crowd and it's this like symbiotic experience.
Yeah.
Cheering and you know
and it's exciting and you're watching and you're just there, but for me that doesn't translate through a screen, and I think for a lot of people it's enough, they want to follow the teams, but I think something's lost when you're not. So I think that a similar idea for poetry is like if you're there, there's presence, there's you know people coughing, and then there's the energy of the speaker, you know, offering this gift and these words that they've, you know, channeled through them. Do you feel like you're channeling when you're writing a poem, or do you feel like you're catching something?
You know,
what does it feel like?
Yeah, you know, I wrote a review of the poet Lewis Warsh once, and there's a line in his poem that I used as the title of the review, which was, "Everyone you've ever met for a moment," you know, and it's like if I'm channeling, it's like channeling everybody I've ever met for a moment, including through reading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you know, and you don't have any idea, you know, it could who that person is.
Right.
So, you know, we're the sum of all these experiences and all these people that we've,
and even the experiences that we didn't have experience. I tend to think when I look at like inspiration or like what motivates me, you know, there's a study on flies, you know, and flies that were under stress, their offspring tend to have, you know, a different reaction to stressors because that was passed on to them, you know. So it's like, it's not just, you know, the experiences that I have, it's the experiences that my parents had and their parents and their parents and then the people that they met, you know.
Yeah.
So
and to add to that, I think so much is unconscious.
Right.
And something, you know, even like dreams even. I remember my dream from last night and someone else happened to tell me their dream, and it's like these things are so strange how they come to us, and I feel like poetry is always a surprise to me. And I could never trace where
when
it came
from.
It? Yeah.
Okay.
When you know, when something comes out, when I'm in this like pool of energy or emotion or experience, and it comes, I can't trace back. Like, I don't know where that came from.
Yeah.
I mean, I can trace like some inspiration, like a thought that occurred to me, or you know, a person, and just feeling like, oh, I need to write a poem about this person, or just what's happening in the moment, you know. And so,
well, that's an interesting question. Go ahead, Gary.
I just one more thing about the dreams, because I think that the dream is very close to what we're talking about, and it always irks me when somebody then tries to translate your dream into some paraphrase, because it seems to me the dream is so as we dream it, it's so insistently itself. And I don't want somebody to tell me this means
you lost your teeth, that means you're feeling like you are losing power, and you don't have you don't have the ability to digest your
you ate
because what's attractive about the dream is the strangeness of
that's true.
And this anything could happen. It's beyond the realm of comprehension or reality.
I mean, there are some poems that have come to me where it's like, this is not my experience, but these are words in my head and I had to like write them down. And so, but I think maybe when it's like conscious poetry, then you know where you're, what inspired that, right?
Yeah.
Whereas when it's like something just like
sitting down with the intention to write.
Yeah.
You mentioned people, and I'm curious if this is an experience you've had. For me, a lot of times I'm inspired to create something for a person I love dearly or met and I'm intrigued by or about them. How much do people influence you in your creative process?
Well, I mean, it's funny because I just sent a couple of poems to a friend and said, and apologized because they're both elegies.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, at our age, we were writing a lot of elegies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's a different, you know, it's like at some point in your life, you're writing a lot of love poems.
Right.
And you're really trying to talk to somebody because you want them to find what you're saying attractive.
Right.
And at other points, you're writing a lot of elegies because people are dropping and you're trying to hold on to them in some way.
Well, I noticed, like, kind of current now, the poetry that I'm writing is like almost angry poetry about the state of our world, you know. And I'm like,
oh my goodness,
you know, I wrote that one for you when I was doing my independent study, and it was like I was so mad, like, just thinking of what we are leaving this the next generation, you know, and like, what are we doing with our life,
so
you know,
problems.
So that was my motivation. It wasn't a person. It was more like, you know, like, holy fuck.
Frustration.
You know, like...
Yeah. If there weren't people coming after,
right.
If there weren't
children
and future generations coming after, when Stephen Hawking says the human race is only has 100 years left, you'd say good riddance.
Right. The AI is going to take over. You're like, okay, fine, whatever.
Yeah.
But no, when you're thinking not just beyond yourself, then I think that's when the angry poetry comes about, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and I think a lot of poetry speaks to smallness, but small things affecting big things, and which is a poetic concept. But also, I mean, these small, you know, switch points that we hit in our trajectory, like, who knows, you know, for example, the single performance coffee with all those pods, and the guy that made them was devastated because they just caught on like wildfire, and now there's, you know, a lot of them are recyclable, but he's like, wow, I think that's just how this world works, is this small thing, you know, surfaces and then just has ripples. Mm-hmm. And so really, reality can be a kind of poetry in the sense that, you know, these butterfly wings or, you know, these words whispered into a void end up shifting something major.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's nice.
I'm listening. Keep going.
Yeah.
That's
I don't talk. I just ask questions.
Well, sometimes when you talk, it inspires a response.
It does.
You know?
That's true.
Not right now, because
I lost my cue cards again. Where did those go?
I think I'm sitting on them.
Isn't it your turn? Let's talk about your current projects, perhaps. You are coming up for your next poetry book. When?
Well, it should be soon, right?
Yeah,
be soon, right? Yeah, it's been
the rhythms
7 years. Yeah, it's been 7 years. So I think there are enough poems that it should be soon. I have a lot of poems that I'm unhappy with because they're not because they're angry, but because the person who's writing them sounds a little bit out of control. I'm not sure what to do about those. So that's a current problem.
Meaning it's that, like, an edge you.
Yeah, like I'm not really. I sit down to write these poems, and then I get carried away, and I start saying things that aren't, that I don't want to stand behind.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
Ooh,
gotcha.
Which speaks to owning your words.
Yeah, yeah.
And does it scare you, like, the things that you'd have to
I just feel like, okay, I got carried away.
All
right. Right? And I'm just trying to figure that out because I don't want to lose. I mean, the anger is genuine.
Mm-hmm.
But but even when you're angry, you still want to be paying attention. You don't want to get so
clouded in the anger
that you're responding in a kind of formulaic way.
Sure. Let me ask you this then. This is something that's come up a few times in the course of my show, of just this idea as a creative person to own your work. And the example I give is this documentary. Shucks, I'm not even going to remember the name. Anyways, it was released and supposedly inspired a person to go out and shoot people. Mm. You know, they credited this documentary. And you cannot take responsibility for the actions of others, but I think what you're speaking to of, like, you know, these words came out and they're not, I'm not comfortable really, you know, pushing them out and being like, go have fun. What do you think about the integrity as a creative person to own what you're putting out and to take responsibility for its impact?
Mm. Well, I think you do take responsibility for what you're putting out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about its impact. I mean, you know, it's like
people have
it's like the case made against
you can't determine what impact it's
right
have
Tupac
on
for kids shooting cops,
right.
You
yeah.
know, and
right.
you can't.
Or
that's,
Marilyn Manson, and
yeah,
Lincoln, you know, Bowling
yeah.
for Columbine, and
yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
So.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, you're not responsible for people twisting
mm-hmm.
what
right.
you what you put out.
Yeah.
On the other hand,
I guess
you are responsible
right.
for what you say. You
right.
know?
Yeah. I mean,
and that's what I'm saying. I don't feel like I want to be responsible for some of these things I'm saying.
Sure.
Right.
And maybe finding a different turns of phrases.
Hmm.
Oh my goodness, my brain is not holding things today. I apologize. I think that's probably normal lately, unfortunately. I was just going to say about, oh gosh, where was I going with this? Are you hungry?
I am hungry.
Sarah's
going to be
on
live.
I'll edit it out, but we'll still be talking about it. Just taking responsibility, as a creative, oh gosh, where was I? I had another thought that I was going to ask your thoughts on. You know what?
Well, I'll ask you a question. So when Swan said that she was going to interview you, I was like, you know, one thing that you told me when we were meeting independently is that, you know, you have a process to prove that you're a poet to the IRS. Right? that was like really
yeah.
interesting. Like you have to
oh, yes.
prove that you're, you know, a writer.
Well, and that was actually, they don't care if you're a writer. What they care is if you're an enterprise. And so
okay.
they really want you to show that you're working
right.
to make money.
Right.
Mm.
And so I was advised to get a lot of as many rejection slips as I could.
Right, that was the thing. Yeah, because we're talking
so,
about rejection
yeah.
and like,
yeah.
I'm afraid
it's
to put my stuff out there.
It's a proof that you're trying.
Yeah,
that you're
wow.
that you're working. That it, but.
And so, do you tally it up and you're like, you know, dear IRS, like, here are all my rejections that I've sent
yeah.
out. And
well,
you know, like,
that was the idea.
Okay.
That was the idea. But you know, over the years, as I've
published,
started to file right. as a employee instead of
mm-hmm.
as a
right.
as a school employee instead of as a writer.
Right. Okay.
I don't need to continue to do that
right, but before,
as much as I did. But when I was filing as a writer
right.
to show that I was not a hobbyist but that I was a writer,
right.
I had to collect all these rejection slips.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Of course, if you know, I mean, if I
what
had a $1 million contract, I probably wouldn't have needed the rejection slips, but
yes.
I didn't.
Right.
Yes.
It's hard to get one of those for poetry.
Right, yeah, if you
yes.
had a contract for that
yeah.
year to write a book of poetry,
yeah.
then that would
yeah.
be different.
That's your work
yeah.
for the
yeah.
year.
So do you keep those, or do you, like, burn them after the year
is no,
done?
No, you know, it's the whole IRS thing is 7 years.
Okay, so you hold
oh
on to 7 years for rejection.
Wow. I mean, Elizabeth Gilbert, who is someone who is very mainstream, but I, like, resent the fact that she inspires me, but she still does. She would keep her early rejection
letters. I still have mine early
as a sense of pride. Yeah. She'd pin them on the wall and be like, good, I need more.
Yeah.
That's hard attitude to maintain.
I would use it as like encouragement. I would like, yeah. Like,
and put this out there.
Yeah.
But well, that's like in a high school, they have a rejection board from colleges.
Oh, yeah.
That the kids put up their rejection slips.
Oh, that's great. That's, yeah.
I remember my thought from before. We're talking about, you know, taking accountability, responsibility for your words. My thought was, you know, if you're writing a poem that's very angry, you might put it out there, but for I think that that's a more, I mean, creative process. For example, heavy metal music. Rather than going out and shooting cops and hurting people, making this really aggressive music about it is like the outlet, becomes the outlet, becomes the release of that anger, that energy, you know, and you can't hold what people do with that, whether they use it as inspiration or not. But I think, you know, speaking to the anger that you feel where you're like, wow, I don't necessarily want to put this out, but I think finding a way to get that anger out is like the job of a creative, of an artist.
Yeah, but I think the way to get it out, I think that's, as you say, that's really the question.
Has to be.
And how do you
so
how
you're
do
focused
you,
on the vehicle of,
yeah, how,
yeah,
how do you
like
make this in a way
something.
that you feel comfortable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're curating, you're creating this package, this like, you know, a vehicle,
yeah.
Of, you know, okay, this can't live inside me.
Yeah.
Right.
So here's how
now, yeah.
Here's how I'm gonna release it.
Right.
I mean, I'm all for the guy in the, you know, corner saying the end of the world is near. I just don't want to be that guy.
So yeah. you're not the mother in the nest pushing the babies out. You're more like, all right, I'm going to put some bubble wrap around you.
All right, so I like to end my shows with a series of rapid-fire questions. So Sarah, as my co-host, you can think of some.
Oh, no.
And we'll all answer them.
Wait, I haven't sold my soul to you yet, so
tapping out. All right, my first question is a new one I just created because I'm so curious. How do you listen to your music? Do you listen?
How do I listen to it?
Yeah. Do you stream it? Do you listen to vinyl?
No, old ways.
Old ways?
Yeah. I either listen
hard copies?
On a radio, or I even have CDs.
CDs?
Okay. My friend Larry Polanski, who's a musician, keeps giving me CDs, and he says, you're the only person I know who still plays CDs.
Yeah, I don't even have a CD player.
Yeah.
Ooh,
at least you didn't say tapes.
Yeah.
Cassette tapes. I wouldn't know what you're talking about.
I know. I still have a box of cassette tapes too, but I don't have anything to play them on.
It's the nostalgia of a mixed tape. And we talked about, you know, you go through these phases in life. You go through phases in life where your mixed tapes are all sappy love songs, and you go through phases of life where your mixed tapes were this. And I think, you know, kids don't get that experience.
I still have my Zune, and if I had the charger for it, there would be so much music that I would be like, God,
oh,
I used to listen to this.
Yeah.
And there's music of me when I was in a band.
Kind of a band?
Acoustic guitar and lots of singing and
sad.
Rent.
Sorta,
no, it was just like whatever. I was undergrad in Virginia, like 20-ish. You know, so having fun. Going to the river, playing music. And
I just play my ukulele.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not very good, but I love it.
All right, I remember.
Question.
Okay. So I saw that there's. What? I have a question for you.
Okay.
But.
How do you listen to your music?
Headphones, and it's usually Amazon and stuff that I've downloaded. I do like to listen to different playlists so that I'm exposed to more different genres of music.
Yeah,
and it's usually on a shuffle, so I don't like to listen to the same thing over and over again. I like it to be
great.
Varied.
Thank you. You had a question for Gary.
Are you going to answer your question?
Oh, my own question. I listen. I'm not proud of it, but mostly Spotify. I do pay for it.
I paid for my Amazon.
And if I listen to something, you know, a lot, I'll buy it because I want to
support them.
I want to be the person that is willing to give my money when I'm consuming something.
Right.
But I definitely use Spotify a lot.
I didn't know that it was a shaming thing.
I'm Well, it's this controversy, as musicians will say, because they don't get paid. If you listen on Spotify, they get nothing. Even if you're paying for premium, that goes to Spotify, not the artists. It's not like the radio. Like, the radio has to play, pay a certain amount each time they play a song. Spotify and other, like YouTube, there's no royalties going to the creators. So that's the thing that's like guilty of, like, I'm sorry.
Right.
Which is why Taylor Swift, you know, was like, Spotify can't play my music because I want the money. Yeah. Anyways, that's a very long tangent. We're not going to go down there. But I am curious in gathering, you know, where do people... It's interesting to me. Right. Even though it has nothing to do with books or writing. Carry on.
All right. So this has to do with writing. I saw that there's an Irish whiskey out there called Writer's Tears. And I was wondering, what is your inspiration elixir? Is it alcohol? Is it coffee? Is it water? Tea?
What's your beverage of choice when you're writing?
Yeah, it depends on the time of day.
You don't start drinking at like 5 a.m.?
No, and I may start writing.
It has to at least be 10 a.m. Come on.
At least 10 a.m. You're right.
And I may start writing at 5 a.m.,
right.
But not drinking, right? But if it's in the evening and I'm writing, then I'm probably drinking,
right?
You know, something other than coffee.
So what's
what is the drink
your choice,
or does it vary?
It varies.
Spice of life variety.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, it varies. I like gin. You know,
nice. Gin is like the new drink, I think, of ours.
Really?
Century.
It seems like an old drink because
I
learned how to do it from my father.
You know, let's have some gin. I'm like,
what?
The first time I tried gin was our neighbors upstairs. They invited us up, and I tried gin for the first time. I was like, this is actually pretty good.
Like a year ago, a month ago.
Months ago, at least. Yeah.
So. It gets better in the summer.
Gin
makes me melancholy.
Oh.
Side note. So if I want to write sad things. my next question for you, Gary, and probably our last question because we're getting close to our time, is will you please speak to a mentor that you had that's kind of shaped your creative person today?
It's hard to get. It's hard to say one mentor, because it, like we said before, you learn different things from different people.
Yes.
But the poet Ron Padgett has been a big influence in my life. First I found his books in the library, and then I went to New York and actually worked for him at the St. Mark's Poetry Project, and then he called me up about 5 years later, and there was another job, and he said, you know, and I went and interviewed for that job and got it and worked with him for another 10 years. So he's been a big mentor in my life, and I'd say another one was Kenneth Koch, who called me up when I was 40 years old and said, would you like to teach poetry at Columbia? And I said, I'm not a teacher. And he said, well, it'll look good on your resume. and I wouldn't be teaching 25 years later if it wasn't because of that, you know?
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much for letting us come talk to you this afternoon. And thank you, Sarah, for also joining.
You're welcome.
As I said before, I love the dynamic of having three people in a room. I think it's a nice balance.
It's nice that we all know each other.
That's true.
So I'm your host, Swan. You've been listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn, and I will leave you with a word, take it or leave it. Paerion.